Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Shayna Maskell, who is the author of Politics of Sound, the Washington, D.C. Hardcore Scene, 1978 to 1983. Shayna, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I would hope you could start off by just talking a little bit about how this book came to be and why you wanted to write about this particular period of time during in DC's history and hardcore history.
Yeah, so this actually started as I feel like so many of these books do, as a dissertation. So I was getting my PhD in American Studies at University of Maryland. I had just come back to the East Coast from a few years in Los Angeles. And so there was this real kind of, you know, not just like nostalgia, but like there is such a cultural difference between the East Coast and the West Coast. And there is no hierarchy here. I love them both in different ways. But when I came back here and I was thinking about what do I want to, you know, do my dissertation on, I mean, music is my favorite thing. I love music. I've always been into music. I've collected vinyl since I was in high school. You know, my parents would play music all the time. My dad would play guitar. I play guitar. And so I was thinking about, you know, what kind of music really represents where I'm from. I grew up in Fairfax, Virginia, which is a suburb right outside of Washington, D.C. Hardcore punk just seemed like a natural fit. It is a music that, for people who know it, is unbelievably meaningful and important and significant, but rarely gets attention kind of outside of the punk scene, and definitely not as much from academia. And so I wanted to not approach it, because there's been some amazing things written about punk from like an oral history perspective. Dance of Days is like the DC hardcore Bible, you know, and there are some other American hardcore has a lot about the DC scene, but I wanted to take, you know, my academic lens to it. And because I was in American studies, I was really interested in intersectionality. So like, how can we understand this music and this music scene as a part of, and, you know, affected by, but also as a construction of things like race, class, and gender.
That's a perfect segue to the next question I had for you, which is, you sort of situate us in DC, right? So it is not like you're saying just like, here's punk and here's hardcore. So can you give us a little bit of background of this time period, late 70s, early 80s in DC, and how that gave rise to these bands and this scene?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think DC is such a weird place, right? So many of us that are here, no one else grew up around here. You know, when you find people, they're always transplants. They come here because this is the seat of the federal government. And there's a huge amount of jobs here. And so there has always been this very interesting divide between kind of, you know, those people who live in DC or the suburbs around DC, and those who come here for jobs. And so that was very true, I think, also, you know, in the 70s and 80s. And so you had, you know, these young people who were in school there with their parents, who were working at local newspapers, who were working in the federal government as well. and kind of, you know, jobs in and around DC. And there, you know, DC has a very kind of controversial history in terms of its relationship with the federal government. It didn't have home rule for so long, and still the purse strings are controlled by Congress. And so there's this idea that there is power centered in DC, but it's not for those who live in DC, or not for those who are from DC. It is those who come and work for it, or who are supposed to represent, you know, these other interests. And I think that was very much a part of what was boiling, you know, in this youth movement, was this lack of agency, right? This lack of power. And it also had to do, I think, very much with the time period in terms of the administration. So you have these young people in the hardcore scene, their parents were the hippie generation, right? And they were very influenced and kind of aware of those failures. And the fact that so much of that social change that that generation, you know, fought for and sought was ultimately doomed to failure by many things, including drugs, which ends up being part of this straight edge movement. But I think also, you know, just this idea that government's not going to really make that kind of change, right? And so there is a little bit of pessimism. And that also goes with, you know, the end of the Carter administration, which was pretty impotent, and the things that were going on in that administration, and of course, which led then to Ronald Reagan. And with Ronald Reagan, this, you know, cowboy Hollywood star who brought about this, you know, now very nostalgic notion of, you know, this dawning, this new morning in America, but really those kind of conservative values were very much at odds with what these young people were feeling.
And so we have, right, we have this, you've sort of set the scene, and there, and it's a short scene too, right? It's not decades, right? But you have five bands that you sort of focus on and talk about as the crux of this scene and space. So can you talk a little bit about each of those bands, just to give us that context for them as well?
Yeah, and I will preface this by saying, you know, hardcore didn't kind of arrive fully formed, sprung from, right, like Bad Brains Head, which are like kind of the grandfathers of hardcore. There was kind of a first wave punk / new wave punk scene in Washington, D.C. And there was a very big divide against those individuals, right, who were a little bit older, and then these kind of young upstarts, right, who were fed up with this kind of mainstream punk sound. And that had to do with, right, the kind of commercialization of the Sex Pistols, you know, the Ramones, and this also kind of commodification of punk through New Wave, Elvis Costello, and things like that. And so you had definitely the grandfathers of the scene were Bad Brains. And Bad Brains are incredible and incredibly important for a few reasons. Two main reasons. One, they were incredible musicians, right? Their punk is a genre that is known not for technical virtuosity, right? Like, that's the point. You don't have to be good at it. It's about, as people say, the three-chord democracy. Here are three chords, here's a guitar, pick it up, you have a band. And so there is kind of a pride that goes along with this kind of amateur musicianship. But Bad Brains were not like that. They wanted to graft that technical skill, speed, right, and volume, with kind of the I don't give a fuckness, right, of punk. Along with that, and inseparable from that, Bad Brains were Black. And this was really important because, with very few exceptions, they're one of the only Black hardcore bands, and definitely all Black hardcore bands in DC. And so they first kind of established hardcore punk, started playing. And it was the young teenagers, Ian McKay, Mackay, and Henry Rollins, right, who went and saw them play and were like, holy crap, I want to do this, right, and befriended them. And so HR and Ian actually, you know, they would share guitars, right? And so I kind of set the scene for the Slinkies, who then became the Teen Idols, who then became probably the most important or recognized band in hardcore, which is Minor Threat. And Minor Threat is associated primarily with Ian MacKaye. And again, because he was a part of these bands with Jeff Nelson, right, as well, Lyle Preslar and Brian Baker, it was about their music, which was so much modeled off of Bad Brains, right? They saw their technical skills and says like, oh, hey, we can actually use that, right? And many of the critics said, oh, there's this huge kind of jump from the Teen Idols to Minor Threat. And like, these boys can play their instruments now. But also their subject matter, right? And that is also what they're really known for, which is, you know, Ian and the band, although Ian has become the unwilling face, I would say the unwilling leader of Straight Edge, right, of this philosophy that was embedded in the music, and then a subculture within a subculture. Within a subculture of Straight Edge, which is, of course, abstinence. For the listeners who don't know, abstinence from drugs, alcohol, nicotine, and kind of promiscuous sex, right? Sex is saved for meaning and loving relationships. And so their music, you know, really became an emblem for not only disaffected youth, but disaffected youth that felt that way because of how youth was being constructed in the mainstream, right? That young people were just, you know, drinking and getting high, both things that were happening at Wilson High School where they attended, but also was in popular culture as well. And those are probably the two heaviest hitters. But I think there can be some great debates and arguments and probably will be about all the bands that I was not able to include. But to me, you know, State of Alert, SOA, occurred for a very, very short amount of time and is probably most well-known because we have Henry Garfield, who becomes, when he leaves DC and goes to California for Black Flag, Henry Rollins. And this was, you know, Ian MacKaye's best friend and, you know, a fellow kind of punk in terms of he acted as a roadie for a while for the Teen Idols and then realized like, well, all these other people are playing kind of shitty music and not doing well. I can do this too. And SOA, I mean, their songs are really short, super furious, and have what we've come to expect from Rollins, this kind of militaristic kind of bombacity and anger with it. And all already kind of this anti-authoritarianism that gets, and not only Black Flag music, but kind of in punk writ large. And then the two other bands, Faith, right, was with Ian's younger brother, Alec MacKaye. And they were really interesting because they brought a little bit more of like a heavy metal sound to their music, which is kind of where hardcore ended up transforming into. And they also were quite involved in the Straight Edge ethos and subculture. And then Government Issue, which GI was fronted by John Stab, who's just like hilarious, was a hilarious character, right? And would shave his head, you know, in front of the audience. And they had more overtly political songs than kind of any of the other bands, who really would draw their material from the personal rather than the political. And Government Issue did as well, but they had, you know, a Hey Ronnie song, right? They had some music that did very specifically address politics. They also had the most lineup changes. I think it's like 21 in total. And so there were always a kind of various states of not only membership, but sound. But during that kind of the pinnacle years, what I call the pinnacle years of 79 to 83, they were very much enmeshed in that hardcore sound and scene.
And you've sort of, so you set us up and then you divided your book into sort of two parts, right? And they build on one another, but I think setting up and talking a bit, and you mentioned this about the race, the class, and the gender, and that is instrumental in creating this space. And you talked a bit about Bad Brains being like a band of Black punk, right, in a time where that really was not exist, and even now, right, we could argue that not, right. But so can you talk a little bit about that sort of the role? We'll start with race, maybe, because I think you start with race, right? So let's start with like how you see the, you know, that role of race and whiteness and what's going on in this scene.
Yeah. And I think, as you said, right, it's interrelated. And I talk about it a lot from the musical standpoint, but that musical standpoint can't be kind of extricated from this larger cultural standpoint. But so I'll start with the musical. And that is, you know, in the book, I kind of talk about Bad Brains, sound of hardcore as this evolution of traditional Black music, specifically through jazz and blues, right? And I think part of the reason that, I'll give the argument as to why I think that, but I think part of the reason why that musical tradition is so important is because jazz and blues historically have been an assertion of Black identity, right? Have been a assertion of Black agency and self in the face of marginalization. And Bad Brains were, you know, in a sea of whiteness. Now, of course, DC itself was Chocolate City, right? And was primarily Black. They actually came from right outside of DC. But the punk scene was by and far white faces, right? With few exceptions. And so their assertion of this musical tradition seems to be a response to the whiteness of that scene. So they're already kind of feeling marginalized, and they enter this scene, which is about bringing together marginalized people, right? And so they have this insider hardcore identity, but still, as, you know, Black hardcore kids, they still have this outsider identity. And so I think, you know, their kind of reinvention of hardcore through this technical virtuosity is very much a response to that. And this is how it links back to jazz, because I really see it as, you know, the bebop musicians, you know, of the jazz era. And my dad was a huge jazz fan and my mom was not. So I grew up listening to jazz with my dad and going to concerts. My mom was like, nope, not going to do it. And so I also grew up on John Coltrane and Miles Davis, right? And all of these musicians. And what I loved about them, right, was this idea that they could improvise, right, that they could on the fly come up with these kind of riffs on the primary melody. And they would do this in order to kind of not only show their chops, but to kind of challenge, right, this white mainstream culture who was like, oh yeah, jazz, like we like that, right? After, of course, you know, America had poo-pooed jazz and said, you know, this is barbaric and this is not a good representation of Blackness. And then once Europe said, oh, this is great, they're like, oh yeah, that's ours, all us, it's an American music. And bebop musicians were a response to that, right? It was kind of a middle finger, like, really, you like jazz? What about this? Can you play this? And I think that Bad Brains do the same thing, right? They're unbelievable speed. I mean, they're unparalleled kind of playing, and everyone kind of still agrees on this. It's not really that debatable that they were masters of this. And to me, that's kind of their way of asserting this marginalized identity. And similarly, this idea of the blues, and I mean, HR and his voice, it's so emotional. It's so laden. It really, to me, recalls a lot of those blues singers, right? And the pain and the anger that they had at this, you know, personal and social marginalization. So I really think, you know, the music was a reaction to the scene. And in fact, Bad Brains started out as a jazz band, right? They were trying to do jazz fusion as Mind Power, and did one concert where HR didn't even face the audience, and it was a disaster. And they were like, okay, let's try this punk thing. So we can kind of see, you know, the way that this, like, Black musical tradition gets reinvented and rethought about through hardcore.
Yeah, that's one thing I really appreciate, right? We often, that music is not a straight linear right line, that it comes and goes. You know, people are like, punk is dead. I'm like, no, it's something different now, right? Like, nothing's ever dying. But thinking about, especially in the context of DC, right, and how even being in that space and the history of that space really informs how these bands come to be and how they're and defines their music, whether it is on their part something they are doing consciously, or it's sort of this unconscious space. So, like, you, and then another thing that'd be right. So we have this role of race, and then we also have class, that middle class, right? We often think of punk as being this very white, middle class, masculine space. And so can you talk a little bit about how you sort of situated that and looked at that?
Yeah, you know, I think I always feel that class is kind of the forgotten vector of difference, right? Because in America, right, we're like, oh no, you know, American dream, social mobility, rags to riches, pull yourself up from your bootstraps. We, you know, we have these kind of myths about class, and we use race instead as our primary kind of lens through which to see things. But yeah, I mean, class becomes really important and interesting, and I mean, punk absolutely historically has been this kind of middle class, kind of performed by middle class boys or men. And I think it actually, to me, is very reminiscent of the hippies, right? And I talked about earlier kind of how these young men saw the failures of the hippie movement. But I think that rang true because, right, hippies were that first subculture that came from the middle class and made a conscious choice to reject the trappings of that class and kind of downward pass, right? They were like, we reject conspicuous consumption. And they had the privilege to do that, right? Because when you're poor, you don't have the privilege to do that, right? You're just trying to make ends meet. And so there is kind of this privilege of middle class of saying, I don't want to do that. I don't agree to, you know, to reinforce these class-based standards. And DC, of course, is just, I don't know, I want to say perfect example, but that makes it seem good. I don't know if it's a good thing. But I mean, DC has always had this disparity, right, of class. I mean, again, you can go down Massachusetts Avenue, right, and Ambassador, you know, Embassy Row, and just these ridiculously gigantic houses, right? Georgetown, very close to where I am now, is just, you know, there's no metro there because they don't want the riffraff coming in, right? It's just all of these shops and these townhouses that are worth millions and millions of dollars that were, and, you know, Georgetown literally was built by and inhabited by slaves early on. And so DC is so small. And I think part of that size makes those disparities in class even more evident, that they were just huge pockets of poverty, almost always intersected by the Anacostia River, right? And you had poor Black and brown people on that one side and the middle and upper class wealthy on the other. And so you did have hardcore punk, and I think sometimes it seems like it's a kind of a negative. I don't think it's negative to acknowledge that they had this privilege, right? Like, as not only these white bodies, but these white middle class bodies, they had this privilege to resist in this certain way, right? Like, and I think this is where, right, Bad Brains, it becomes really interesting too, because generally we associate, like, you know, particularly Black men with hostility and anger and aggression, right? But white men are allowed, as we have seen in these last, right, 4 to 6 years, allowed to do this, right? It is their God-given right to do this. And so I think, you know, I think that Minor Threat and Faith and SOA and Government Issue and all these other bands, you know, were able to engage in that kind of resistance, that sound resistance as sound, in large part because they came from that comfort of middle class. And they were taken seriously, they weren't taken seriously, but they got the chance to take themselves seriously by recording. I mean, recording, you know, is such a privilege to have things memorialized in that way. And so there is such an interesting kind of contradiction that was going on in that scene of this middle class privilege and then this very intentional kind of downward passing, right? Like, we're going to play raw, we're going to not, you know, there's no use of upper class instruments like the violin and the viola and these things that we associate with a higher class. And even the kind of more amateurish way that they played, although I would argue Minor Threat plays quite well, technically well, it has something to do with this kind of attempt to present a rawness, right? This kind of minimalism, no frills consumption, right? That gets associated not with the middle class.
Right. And along with that, like you mentioned this role of the white male being able to sort of be angry, right? Gender mm-hmm. and masculinity play such a strong role. And as someone who's very interested in women and feminism and punk, mm-hmm. right? And that there are people who sort of came out, you know, there are females who came out of DC in that scene, but that gender role is so, and masculinity is so important in that space.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that we could pick apart anything that we just talked about and it wouldn't be linked to masculinity in some way, right? I mean, obviously masculinity is the default for everything. And so in that way, it's associated with everything. And there were, of course, women in the scene, and there were women who were important to the scene. But I think, you know, often those roles were in the traditional gender roles, right? You had women as photographers, women as you know, behind the scene, putting together things at the Discord house for the albums to send them out. You didn't have women being given that voice, that literal voice, right? And absolutely Riot Girl, right, that emerged from there was that reaction. But, you know, the way that hardcore, the sound of hardcore, the performance of hardcore with slam dancing, right, with even kind of dress, all of it pointed to this kind of hyper masculinity. And I think, again, like, that is very much of the times, right? Late 70s, early 80s, you have this backlash against women's rights and the women's movement, and this idea of feminism, right, which is a dirty word, well, still is to many considered a dirty word. And then you have, you know, right in DC, the emblem of power being all white men, right? Like, you had very small little inroads that were happening. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor and there was like a couple of maybe one senator who was a woman. But in general, you know, power is always linked to the notion of masculinity. And there is a reaction to that, I think. There's a reinforcement to that that's going on. And I don't think it's conscious, right? And I was really, you know, privileged to talk to Ian a number of times throughout this book. And he really always wanted to make clear, like, we embraced women. Like, we did not think of it as, you know, as a male club or an all-boys club. And I think that's probably true. But I think that, right, consciously or otherwise, there was this hyper-masculinity that's equated with power. And so that gets replicated and reproduced in the music in the scene, particularly when you're in reaction to, you know, the Georgetown military punks, right? And those with, you know, federal power, the armed, you know, the armed forces, all these things that are going around in DC that are actual corporeal, physical power.
Yes. And that it kind of leads into, right, that second part, you talk about some of the cultural production, the DIY, the straight mm-hmm. edge, and it leads into, like, yes, like, so even embracing women, there's still some very misogynistic ways in which the scene operates. I look at zines, so I think of even some of the names of those mm-hmm. zines and some of those ways in which that, even if it's a joke, or even if it's thought of to be a joke or tongue in cheek, it still comes out. But one of the, mm-hmm. you know, so we have this music, but they've also, it's not only the music, right? They really did create a scene. And mm-hmm. so I'd love for you to talk a bit about that. You know, I mean, we have Discord Records, they have the Discord mm-hmm. House, but how did they, you know, talk a little bit about how you really see this coming together as a scene and not just bands?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the most kind of incredible things about, you know, punk writ large, but hardcore specifically, is that hardcore across the country did have these scenes, right? And this idea of scene is very much premised on this kind of, like, you know, postmodern way of understanding that there is no, not only high and low culture, but there is no, you know, singer and then audience, right? There's not the band and then the fans, that it's about creating this community. And I think that, you know, part of it had to do with spatial relations, right? The DC hardcore scene really came from like three high schools in DC, which there were only really like not very many more than that. I mean, there were a few more, right? And the other side of that, of course, is go-go that was going on in DC, right? The go-go scene. And so, but for the kind of, you know, there was such a small, the city is so small that it really did allow for these kids to be in constant kind of contact with one another. Part of the other thing was that whenever these bands would try to play at kind of a more traditional venue, they nearly always got banned, right? So as you know, Bad Brains, one of their most famous songs, Banned in DC, right? Is that people were like, you're never coming back here, right? And so these venues were often done in the homes of people in the scene, right? In their basements, in community centers. And because of this DIY ethos, not only, and so I'll say two things about the DIY, do it yourself. One is that, as we're talking about with class, there was this very conscious rejection of the music industry, right? And like that was what was wrong with mainstream punk, right? But also kind of the history of music as a whole. And so there was this, you know, creation of Discord really as a way of just getting their music out, right? Like the Teen Idols had Ian's first band with Jeff Nelson had toured and they had some leftover money. They're like, well, we can like $500, like we'll split it, or we could like try to put out a record. And everyone's like, yeah, sure, let's put out a record. And everything else came from that. Well, let's put out our friends' records, right? And so there was this, again, you see that kind of class-based thing, like this is worth preserving, right? This is worth people hearing. But it was also so much of this idea of community, right? Let's do this together. And so these teenagers went and, right, rented this house, got this house that I now live a block from, which is always a treat. My kids and I are always walking by, right? Along with all of the people who journey to the Discord house to take photos in front of it, right? And they had everyone from the scene, not just from the bands, that were, you know, getting the orders from across the country, that were putting together these albums, that were stealing cardboard outside of the dumpster of the 7-Eleven to mail these records from. And so all of that kind of brought about the sense of community. And of course, that second part was more practical of DIY, which is that no one else would do it for them, right? Like no one else thought that this was worthwhile. No one else thought that this kind of music was financially viable, but also had any kind of cultural or social value. And so it was of necessity that they formed, you know, this DIY community and this ethos that went along with it.
Right. And I think one thing that's really, I think, important about looking at this time and looking at DC and these bands is because they kind of helped to bring that to other scenes, right? Mm-hmm. They were these bands that would travel. I just interviewed two men who wrote Punks in Peoria, talking about the Peoria scene, but even talking about when Minor Threat came through and they were saying, we don't have any money, you know, like Ian being like, here, take my money, right? Like, so like, and that was like an important, like that band who was so important coming through and doing that, right? But they have done this, right? You know, like even when you talk about Henry Rollins moving across the country and bringing things to LA and things to California, you know, California area. Mm-hmm. So I think, right, like this DC scene is important to see how to do, I mean, not everything is right, right? But, you know, again, yes. Like that's not the right word, but how to do this, like you're talking about with no book to tell you how.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. You know, there's always kind of, you know, I think of it somewhat, although I don't think it's completely accurate, as like spontaneous invention, right? Like happening at the same time you had it in LA and you had it in DC, but these were really the first two kind of hardcore scenes, and particularly for the East Coast, but I love, you know, in Midwest, absolutely Texas too, right? Like the DC scene were kind of these like elder statesmen, which is weird to be talking about for like 18-year-olds, right? But they were the elder statesmen. And even though there was some ferocious kind of territorial, right? But I mean, actual physical fistfights often, right? With the New York scene and the Philly scene. And
I lived in Philly. So the Philly, I grew up in the Midwest, but I lived in Philly for a long time, right? Yeah. My kids were born. So the Philly fight, it is legendary, right? Yes, very legendary. Were you there? Who was there? Who threw the first, like, why did it happen? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But like even, and there were tons of that. And there was, you know, and Bad Brains had a lot of issues, right, with homophobia, and HR was a drug addict and would steal money. But despite all of this, absolutely, I think there was this kind of familial structure, right? That was very much a part of that DIY, right? We're a community, we help each other. And Ian is just like ridiculously generous with his time and with everything else. I mean, he'll talk to anyone, which is just incredible, but he does that with, you know, musicians and, you know, lowly academics like me and, you know, fans that, you know, that come to the house. I mean, he's always willing to do that. And I think that is so much in that spirit, right? Of like, this non-elitist kind of spirit, like we are all together doing this. There's not this kind of division between us.
And he has figured out how to continue that for literally 40, right? Decades and decades and decades, right? 40 years. And he also becomes really important, whether you want to or not, like whether he wants this title or not, as like founding Straight Edge, right? Like you have this DIY, but then a really important part of creating a scene. And you mentioned it a little earlier, but I'd love you to talk a little bit more about Straight Edge and that role.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he always likes to say it's a personal philosophy. It's not a political philosophy, but of course, and you know, as feminists, you know, the personal is political, right? And absolutely, he doesn't like to be thought, because of the things we're just talking about, this kind of communal notion, he doesn't want to be thought of as a leader, right? Like he would really hate that. But his ideas and thoughts on Straight Edge, and of course the famous song Straight Edge, and there are others out of step as well, became these rallying anthems for these young people who wanted to assert their agency, not through a kind of cultural depiction of the vagaries of youth, right? And I think, I mean, I think many things about Straight Edge, but I think it's such an interesting assertion of self, because this is going on down the road from the Reagan White House and the Just Say No. I mean, I very much remember, I was a little too young for the hardcore scene here in DC. I grew up more on Fugazi, you know, Ian's later band, but I very much remember Just Say No campaigns and people coming in and, you know, this is your brain on drugs and it's a fried egg in the pan. And so in some ways, Straight Edge is baffling, right? It's like, oh, really, you align with the Reagans and Just Say No? But of course, that wasn't what was going on. It was instead a generational statement about the young people that they saw in high school, or, you know, going to concerts and seeing people passed out and like not even getting to remember seeing these famous bands. It was a way of saying, you know, I am asserting my consciousness and my awareness above everything else. And I talk about the book. It is a very gendered kind of concept, right? Particularly back in the day. But, you know, women weren't supposed to have sex at all, and definitely not promiscuous sex. So saying like, no promiscuous sex, well, no shit. Like that was already on the table. It was men who were supposed to, you know, and are rewarded still in many areas for having, you know, as much sex as humanly possible, right? That's like the sign of virility in youth. And same with drinking. Drinking is often typically been the purview of young men and also young male rituals, whether it's, you know, bachelor parties or football or, right, just like, you know, Friday night and darts, right? It is very much about masculinity. And so there was this way that Straight Edge seemed to be a reconfiguring of masculinity. And so where you had this kind of reinforcement of hyper-masculinity through music and dance, you had this really interesting subversion of it through Straight Edge, right? And this kind of way, again, it's still centered masculinity. So of course, you know, we'll do without what we want, but there was this way of kind of asserting that masculinity doesn't have to be the stereotypical notion of drinking, smoking, right, doing drugs and getting laid. It can be this assertion that, you know, I care about myself, my body, and those around me, and so I'm not going to do any of this. I've got the edge.
And this really leads to, we talked about it a little before, but like that embodying of masculinity in all the ways, right? You talked a bit about performance, but also for, you know, not only for the bands, but those within the scene, right? To like, we mentioned the Philly fighting and you have that here, right? But like starting fights, you know, a lot of a lot of, you know, half naked bodies, slam dancing, all right. Like, so, so there's a lot of this. So can you talk about how the role, right? So that comes out in the music, but it's also super important to the creation of this space and scene.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the body itself is this site, a struggle, right? So you have this idea that this, there's this subversive masculinity going on with straight edge and like what you're not going to consume in your body. But then you also have is how your body is going to perform in the world, right? And so you have, you know, fashion, right? And this idea of, you know, straight or not just straight edge, but hardcore more specifically was about, you know, shaved heads. That was kind of the look, right? It went from the kind of skater long hair to this militaristic kind of, right, haircut, the buzz cut, which they could get mistaken for, you know, Marines that were walking around. I mean, not in the other ways that they were dressed. But then, of course, you had the dress itself, right? The kind of dress that kind of has been stereotypically categorized as punk, right? With chains and spikes and safety pins. But they served a practical, you know, role as well. And that's that those same Georgetown Marines who they might look like tried to kick the shit out of these hardcore kids for looking like freaks, right? We're so used to, I mean, my four-year-old has a mohawk, right? Like, and that's not that weird anymore. Like, of course he has a mohawk. But when you saw that and then, you know, in the early 1980s, you crossed the street. Like, you did not want to be around that person. And that was older generations, whereas other were like, who are these freaks? And so you had these kind of symbols of violence, right? That were, yes, absolutely were an assertion, right, of dominance, of violence, a threat. But they were also a response to the real kind of physical threat that they faced on kind of a day-to-day basis. So you had definitely this that kind of hyper-masculinity in hair, in body, as you said, right? Like, and part of it has to do with, like, you were in these where they were performing. There wasn't like a lot of air conditioning, right? Like, and it's a show. So, yes, there would be, you know, shirts stripped off, bodies kind of glistening. And there was very much this, I mean, you know, to play hardcore and to be a hardcore fan is super physical. It really is. And there is this kind of endurance and dominance that you need to climb up onto the stage and stage dive or walk on people's heads, which my husband says is the thing he misses most about hardcore and being old, right? Like, it takes a lot of force. And so there's absolutely this idea of the hyper-masculinity that the body performed in the music, in the scene, in the dancing, right? Or dancing is a loose kind of word, I think, right? But in this kind of expression, right, of music, this kind of physical expression of music that would go on at the shows.
Now, I also have, it was after this. So when he had the Henry Rollins band, I still remember to this day, this tour shirt that, like, to me says everything. It was like, be strong, get stronger, right? Mm-hmm. Like that idea of like, this is the goal, right? You know, that physicality is super, yeah, like, and owning and being in that space. And that, like you said before, is very, a very sense of masculine, right? Men are taught to take up the space. Mm-hmm. And you see this sort of happening in the slam dancing, in these ways in which these men, like you talk about, are able to move and be and just take up space. Which sometimes, yes, makes it another way where even if women are invited in, women are not taught to take up space in those same ways.
Yeah. And it doesn't feel quite as safe. I mean, even, right, like if you're on the outskirts, I mean, I remember, I don't know, 10 years ago seeing a new iteration of Dead Kennedys, right? But I had a friend who was the new lead singer and I went to visit and I was trying to get, like, you know, near the front. I just got like elbowed right in the ribs and like had this tear. I mean, it was, and this is like 2000s, right? So this is way past the scene. And it feels like an intentional statement. And again, whether or not it's intentional, that's the effect that it has. And that becomes important to think about. And that assertion of masculinity, of taking up space, I think was also in reaction to them feeling like they couldn't or didn't in other areas of their lives, right? Like at their high school, in their way of being in DC. And so it was like it was not only socially and culturally taught, but then also a personal reaction to this, where they were.
And so for you, right, so you set this up and you bring us into this, and but as we said before, this scene did not last decades, right? Like there was, you know, very early on, there was a bit of a transformation, you know, collapse of these bands moving into, right. And as I usually say in these, when I talk to folks about punk, I blame Ronald Reagan for most of it, right? Like, because it all comes back to like, what was going on. And so can you talk a little bit about that, right? What happens after 1983 and this sort of transformation and the change in this?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors, right? One is Minor Threat breaks up, right? And it seems like that shouldn't necessitate a complete, and it doesn't necessarily, you know, write the end of DC hardcore, but they were so important to the scene. And part of why they broke up was this kind of outsider view that they were back together again just for money, right? Which was, but also, and I think this links to one of the second reasons, they start to move apart musically. And hardcore is a pretty rigid sound, right? Like it doesn't really invite for much evolution. Like this is the way that it's supposed to be played, right? This is the way that it's supposed to sound. And so that rigidity kind of, I think, spelled its, I don't want to say it's doom, because I do think, right, hardcore still, and my husband would kill me if I said, right, we often argue about when the heyday of hardcore is, right? But definitely in its form in DC, right, spelled the end of it there. And everyone kind of in Minor Threat wanted to move in other directions. I think the external aspects were also really important. And part of that was also this idea of violence, right? DC had become known as like a scene that is not afraid to kick some ass, right? And what happened is that people started coming to the scene just to participate in violence. And so violence became not a reaction to what was, you know, what this scene perceived as kind of, you know, an attack on them, but became like the purpose first and foremost. And that was not what the original people kind of hardcore scene was supposed to be. And then I think absolutely, I mean, part of it had to do with these young kids were getting older, right? And as they got older, I think there was this more, you know, realization that we do live in DC. We are at the center of power, and maybe we need to pay more attention. And they did, right, to the overt politics. And yes, Reagan, right? I mean, these kind of disastrous policies that he was implementing, there was much more of a feel that like, this is something that we as a community should be reacting to. And so I think that all spelled, you know, this evolution and transformation. And so the music of DC, I think, started to slowly change. And I'm sure there are some who would get into a spirited argument with me, right? Whether or not like, we should put Scream as hardcore or post-hardcore, right? We're Marginal Man. But really to me, it became, you know, the addition of, you know, different instruments. Like the influences of these different sounds started into this post-hardcore slash, and everyone hates this label, but emo sound, which makes like a whole generation of people gag. And then a whole other generation be like, oh, that was my youth and childhood. But it was a different generation. So, and I think that right, like that sound started reflecting those exterior things that were going on. So hardcore, like, you know, it evolved and it spread and it dissipated throughout the country in different ways. And I think made its mark on all of these different genres. But I don't think it could have ever lasted in DC for any longer. You know what I mean? I think that the scene as it's the music itself, but also this community, as they grew up and as they moved on, so too did the scene and the music.
Right. And that makes, right, that makes sense. Do you see, or like, maybe I should ask it this way. What do you see as some of those then like really lasting influences on not only, you know, punk and hardcore, but just the music scene in general? What do you see that like from this moment in time, like how has this influenced how we think about music and like participation and scenes?
Yeah, I think still many people don't know about DC hardcore. But when they learn about it, it starts to make sense with so many of the other musics, right? I teach a music class at George Mason University, right? And I always, of course, make them listen to it since, you know, I'm like, okay, here. And this summer was the first time I'd had any students who had ever heard them, right? I was just like, holy crap, this is amazing. But I think that, like, it brings those sounds are not radical anymore. I used to teach at the Corcoran College of Art and Design, which has been since subsumed by another university, by George Washington University. And they had, it's an art museum that is also an art school. And they had an exhibit on DC punk and DC hardcore and go-go. And I remember taking my parents to it. My mom was kind of looking at the exhibits, and I this is when we still had iPods. And I put in, I was like, why don't you listen? I put a mix on for you so you can listen to hardcore while you go around. And it was Bad Brains, Pay to Come. And she's like looking and she's like nodding, bobbing her head. And she's like, oh, I like this. And I was like, holy shit. Like, my mother is saying this. That clearly shows this idea that, you know, what was abrasive and ferocious and ostracizing sound has so become part of the sound of, like, alternative rock as a whole, that my mom was like, oh, this sounds good. It's got a good beat, right? Like, there was just a perfect, you know, like coming together of this music has its fingers in, you know, alternative rock and Husker Du and right, like in the mountains and Sonic Youth, right? And it has its fingers in grunge. Of course, Dave Grohl, who played for in Scream before he went to Seattle and Nirvana. I mean, Riot Girl, absolutely, right? That Ian was very invested in. Not financially, right, but kind of socially and culturally. I mean, I think we see those tentacles reach wide. And I think Straight Edge is one of also the long-lasting legacies. I think it is such a still vibrant and important community for so many, that is something that will always be one of the most important legacies of DC hardcore.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about at the end of your book, right? So we talk about these sort of lasting legacies. You have a discography, right? And it's not just these bands. So I just wanted to, like, what made you choose the bands that, yeah, you don't have to go through everything in there, but right, you have, you have Bad Brains in here and Government Issue and Minor Threat, but you also have like some, you know, classic, maybe more classic punk or punk adjacent. I mean, I would call Patti Smith punk, but like, who knows? Somebody else might not. And the Velvet Underground as well. So like, what brought, like, was there certain...
Yeah. Well, and this is actually a good point because this is like a chapter that got cut out of the book, right? And that was more about the evolution of sound, right? And so, you know, hardcore wouldn't exist without proto-punk and kind of without, I mean, obviously rock and roll, but kind of the more, you know, it, absolutely, they're very like kind of blurry lines between what do we call, you know, Velvet Underground. But I don't think there would be, you know, hardcore without Velvet Underground, right? Like, I think that like dissonance, right? And kind of experimentation. And even though it's so far apart on so many things, right? I mean, that's very kind of art rock, right? Velvet Underground. And, you know, hardcore would be like, fuck that. Like, that is not something that we agree with. It's almost progressive rocky. But still, I think those attitudes and those kernels of sound become really important. So I think of it a little bit as kind of this, the chapter that got removed, right? So like the evolution of sound, you know, through the 60s to the 70s, and then that comes up to DC hardcore.
Mm-hmm. So this book, is it out yet, or is it just coming, like,
September 28th.
Okay, perfect. So it comes out September 28th, end of the month. So, I mean, I usually, my final question is usually like, what are you working, if there's anything else you're working on now, which, I mean, you might be, but, or if there's anything happening with the book that you sort of want to promote and put out there.
In this era of COVID, unfortunately, I don't have as very much planned for it. But, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, I've been working a little bit more and on social justice, issues on social media, but I've been thinking about like how I want to bring it back to music. And so, you know, I don't know yet. I haven't started the next project. I've given myself a break. But I'm really kind of thinking like, I want to see like how this notion of music and scene and community, right, gets so changed and transforms and evolves through social media. So I'm it's just percolating in my head and will perhaps come as a full form thought sometime soon.
Well, it has been really amazing talking to you about, I mean, we could probably talk forever, but we've been talking a while. But again, this was Shana Maskell, who's the author of Politics of Sound, the Washington, D.C. hardcore scene from 1978 to 1983. Shana, thanks so much for talking with me on New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.